Hello, everyone. This is another Base Camp gathering. It's a campfire conversation. This is Sam Williamson. I have with me Gary Barkalow. And then we are going to be talking with an old friend of mine named Jim Balmer. I knew Jim back in the early 80s. He and I were friends together in a Christian group in Ann Arbor Mission, a Christian community. And I actually knew his wife in the 70s. She probably doesn't want me to say that, Jim. Because she and I went to school together. We were in the dorms together. And I recently reconnected with Jim, and after actually not having seen him for over 20 years, and it's just been a delightful time. He and I spent a couple hours in his office, and then last Friday we spent a couple hours around dinner. And Jim just has a really fascinating story of being in addiction himself, and then getting into recovery, and then starting a nonprofit organization that helps people with rehabilitation and with recovery. It's an organization called Don Farm that I think you started, Jim, I don't know, 30 years ago.
I helped start. For
you helped
40,
start. You helped
40,
start.
40 years ago, believe it or not.
Okay. So, Jim, tell us just a little bit about your early life, sort of your addiction and how you got out of some addiction. I mean, I think it's just interesting for a lot of guys.
Well, yeah, I was a child of the 60s, you know. I mean, I was born in the Truman administration, and I was kind of a precocious child, so I was pretty precocious when it came to mood altering substances. I used from age 12 to 19. So
you used from age 12.
Yeah, I took my first drink and I bought my first pack of cigarettes with two dimes in a machine in a bowling alley. And I actually smoked a lot. I quit smoking a long time ago too, but I took to it. I still remember fondly my first drink. Different people respond different ways, but I was certainly one of those people who, you know, I joke I took my first drink at age 12, but I probably could have used it when I was 8.
So you weren't so precocious after all. You were slow.
My sort of internal state wasn't very good. I grew up with a lot of privilege. I went to a school for gifted children, but I could have used a drink way early. And I loved it. There were very few drugs I met that I didn't like. And by the time I was, sophomore in high school, I had already injected drugs. And I had, by the time I graduated, barely graduated high school, I was really full-blown addicted. I was injecting methamphetamine and heroin and slamming Seconals and drinking a lot and tripping. I tripped probably 500 or 600 times, took hallucinogens. And that
Where
was just
living?
Recreational. I lived in Oakland County, just north of Detroit. But
was it readily available?
It was the 60s. You know, it was, you know, the Detroit area in the 60s. You know, I hung around on a place called Plum Street on Cass Corridor near Wayne State University.
Oh, I know that area.
It was rock and roll and anti-war. And, you know, I was real active in the anti-war movement.
What was it like for you to be, I mean, you say now that you were addicted. Would you have said then you were addicted? Or were you just saying?
Eventually, yeah. Well, when you stop and you get really sick, then you know you're addicted. That's a bad sign.
What does really sick mean?
Oh, well, I mean, going to bad withdrawal, you know. And I started getting sicker. That was a place where my sort of precociousness didn't help me because I got in real trouble pretty fast. By the time I was 18, I was physically addicted. I got a case of hepatitis, which is nasty, where your liver gets distended and I turned yellow And I got physically ill as a result of my addiction. And of course, other things were going on. I'd ripped off a drug dealer. I wrote a bunch of bad checks. I'd gotten a drug dealing arrest and then to compound it, I think I mentioned to you that, you know, I was a draft resister. I went through the whole CO process.
The what process?
Conscientious objector process.
Yep.
And then one night, and in, you know, 1970, my lottery number was 6. people my age are sort of defined by their lottery numbers. And I, one night I was drunk. It's a terrible thing to do. I was drunk and I wrote a letter to my draft board, which is something you never want to do.
While you're drunk.
While you're drunk, yeah. And I basically kind of told off the Pontiac draft board. And I was 1A very quickly. And so there were a lot of things piling up on me. So I actually left the state. I hitchhiked up 401 in Canada and ended up living in a commune. This is like iconic 60s stuff. I ended up living in a commune in Barrie, Vermont with 18 other people.
Who were also drug addicts?
Many. Well, it was a mixture. The running joke was... Yeah, the joke was that we would drive up to Waterbury State Mental Institution every week to see whichever of us was there. Because there was always one of us who was there.
And are you there just drying out? Are you there because you got caught by the police? What?
Oh, no, this was state mental institution, so the people who were there because they were, like, nuts. And I actually eventually, the people in this house eventually got so concerned about me that they had me, they went through the process of attempting to get me committed into that facility. Because I was crazy. I was, you know, impaired.
What were you doing that made them so concerned?
This is a
side of you that I knew existed, but I never heard this. I don't know anything about it.
It's kind of it's an old story, you know. I mean, yeah. I mean, I was shooting a lot of dope. I was doing a lot of drugs. I was dealing a lot of drugs. You use enough drugs, you become kind of psychotic. So I sort of did. I became psychotic. I mean, they weren't out of line for trying to get me hospitalized against my will. I mean, and I actually escaped. I left the state, hitchhiked back. I hitchhiked down through New Jersey, Philadelphia, across into the Midwest, and ended up in a hospital primarily because there was a doctor friend of my folks who pleaded with me to go into the hospital. And I spent a couple weeks in the hospital with hepatitis. I mean, at that point, I was, like, yellow, you know. My skin was the color of a banana, and I was, you know, my urine was black. It's a pretty dismal scene.
So, Jim, where are your? I mean, it's the first time I've heard you say anything about your folks. But where are your folks in all these years with this drug abuse and all of this stuff going on?
God bless them, you know. For a long time, they didn't know where I was. I mean, I would disappear. Just this year, we were talking about seeing them at Christmas time and then leaving, and they went, I don't know, 4 months where they didn't know if I was alive or dead. You know, that was actually kind of common. So, you know, I mean, they were powerless. You know, they weren't in a position where they could do anything about me. So, they cared. They were real concerned, but they couldn't really do anything. So they did. They allowed me to talk to this doctor who persuaded me to go into this hospital. But I got out of the hospital, and within a couple of weeks, I was using again. So,
how did you stop using? What happened?
Well, it was a funny time, you know. In those days, there was not much. Most of the treatment centers wouldn't take somebody like me because I injected drugs. So there were the options available to me. I could have gone to a place called Synanon, which was a kind of a therapeutic community that ended up kind of turning into a cult. I could have gone to the federal program in Lexington, Kentucky, which was run by the federal prison system for IV drug addicts. But actually what ended up happening to me was it's a great story. I was in a parking lot. I was waiting for some friends, and I was high. And a guy who I vaguely knew walked over to my car, a guy quite a bit older than me, and said, I won't say exactly what he said. He said, I don't know exactly what's wrong with you, but you are screwed up. That's not precisely what he said.
You can use real language on occasion with us.
But,
nobody
hears
you're terribly shocked.
Okay. But he said, I'm going into this meeting. Would you like to come with me? and it's funny because that never happens. And he took me into a 12-step meeting. This is 1971.
And where was this? I mean, at this point, I don't know where you are. Are you in Vermont?
I'm in Oakland. I'm in Michigan now. Yeah.
You're back in Michigan.
Yep. And I knew nothing about AA or NA or any of those things. And he walked me into this meeting. I have no memory of the actual meeting. The only thing I remember this vague sense of hope that that if I did what these folks told me, that I might survive. I wasn't at that point. I was at what we sometimes call the jumping off spot, where, you know, I was getting high, but it wasn't really deliver. I mean, I wasn't getting anything good out of it, and I couldn't stop. You know, so you can't use and you can't stop. It's a kind of a terrible place to be. So this guy walked me in. I sat down. They gave me a cup of coffee, and I listened. And I they said, "Well, please come back." And of course, and it was funny too because I was culturally way different from these guys. These guys, you know, back in those days, people with 12-step groups, they you know, they wore coats and ties, and you know, and they were quite a bit older than me. And I walked in. I had a beard down to the middle of my chest. I had hair down to my waist. I was a colorful figure. Most of them, people had never seen anybody like me up close. You know, so they were. You know,
yeah, they couldn't tell if you had a tie or not because it was covered by your beard.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, we joke about it. You know, my wife and I joke about it that I was sort of an iconic hippie type at the time. But this is, you know, this is summer of 1971, mm-hmm. 19 years old. So, and what happened was I stayed, and I was really impaired. I really, at a certain point, I stopped using. But I honestly couldn't remember when it was, and the leader of the group came to me a year later and said, "We want to give you a cake for your anniversary, for your 1 year. What day was your last drug?" And I honestly couldn't tell them. And so they sat down, my sponsor and the head of that group, they sat down and they started to talk, and they said, "Well, when did Balmer start looking not so goofy?" and they figured that sometime around mid-July, I started looking better. And so they added a month just to be on the safe side. And that's my sobriety anniversary date is August 15th, 1971.
So it's a calculated date.
Yeah, it's the best guess. And, of course, those people are all dead now. I mean, the people who've worked it out. So
that's because they were all old folks.
Well, so, yeah. I mean, at the time, they were in their 30s. You know, it's pretty funny.
So was your coming off of those drugs, it doesn't sound like it was real difficult. You didn't mention anything about really awful withdrawal.
Oh, yeah. Well, what do you say? I mean, yeah. No, I've had my share of awful withdrawals.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unpleasant. You know.
So, Jim,
and,
I want you...
And I had health problems for years after I got sober.
Because of the physical effects of the drugs?
Oh, yeah.
Nutrition or malnutrition?
Yep. I had malnutrition. I had vitamin deficiency. I lost teeth. All sorts of stuff. So I had all sorts of terrible.
So I want to just shift gears for a minute. So
yep.
You just talked about recovery at age 19 or 20
yeah.
back in 1971. And then when you and I were having dinner on Friday, you were telling me about a story about Kazakhstan that take place in, what, 2005? I don't quite even remember.
No, that was
maybe
that
early
was 2000.
Okay, so in early 70s, you start your recovery.
Right.
Later on, you help start this thing called Dawn Farm, which is recovery, which we'll talk about. But then tell us a little bit about your sort of passion for recovery as you tell the story of being invited to come to Kazakhstan. So, you know,
well, just to put, I mean, yeah, in context, I mean, you know, what happened was I got sober and I stayed sober, and then, you know, so time, and then, like you say, in 70, and I moved to Ann Arbor in 1972. In 1973, I took a job at the local community mental health center and participated with these two other guys in the founding of the farm, of Dawn Farm. And at that time, it was a residential therapeutic community for addicts and alcoholics. And so, yeah, so, and then I came to work there full time as the clinical director 30 years ago, May. So, you know, so I've been involved, you know, my early career was actually dealing in mental health with mental health folks, but then I ended up being involved in the treatment of addicts. So I went actually a long, decent long time, you know, although I was on the board of the farm, I went quite a period of time where I didn't work with addicts, but last 30 years I have. So.
Okay.
But, well, so Kazakhstan was just, I was approached by a mission, a Catholic mission organization, and they said, we'd like to, we wonder if you'd be willing to come on a mission trip to Kazakhstan. And I said, well, I'm a Christian, I'm a Catholic, but I'm not, I don't see myself as missionary. It doesn't sound like a great thing. And they described how they had been involved there. And everywhere they went, people said, well, you know, this Christian stuff is good, but do you know anybody who knows anything about alcoholism? And so they thought of me. And apparently there was a German priest in Karaganda, Kazakhstan, who had gotten a hold of a Russian translation of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And he'd sat down with some of the worst alcoholics in his parish, and he started reading this book to them. And reportedly, a half a dozen of them got sober. And the priest was so excited that he decided to do a Bible study with them, and they all got drunk.
That is the funniest story I've ever heard.
And of course, I heard it, and I said, "Oh, absolutely! I can totally understand." I said, "You need to give them the book, give them that blue book, and leave them alone, right? Because alcoholics have a kind of a synergy with one another that is special when they, you know, it's why programs like AA and NA work, because they when they relate to each other, it's special. I've seen it all over the. I've been on a number of different places, seen it again and again. But so I'm hearing about this Kazakhstan. So I said, well, I guess I would be interested in going. I could go wearing two hats, both as a professional and as a recovering person, and I guess I would be willing to do that. And then they told me that it was going to cost me $3,000 to $5,000 to go, and I said, well, screw that.
They're inviting you to come, and they're asking you to pay.
Yeah, I got to pay my own way. And I had my oldest was in college, and I just said, you know, and not probably, you know, I'm not making a lot of money. And I just said, well, I just can't do it. And they were clearly disappointed. They really wanted me to come, but I just said, I can't do it. And then what happened was I went to the, this international conference in Minneapolis in 2000. One of the things they do is they have a representative flag ceremony of all the people, all the different countries where 12-step recovery is represented. And I'm sitting
so
there
where
in the
Minneapolis. Is this in Minneapolis?
I was in the Minneapolis Metrodome. And there
it's
were
the
65
Metrodome.
Yeah, there were 65,000 recovering alcoholics and addicts in the room. Hmm. And there, you know, the flags are coming down, and you know, Armenia and Australia, and you know, they get to the K's. And there's no Kazakhstan, and I know there's no Kazakhstan because I know that there's exactly one 12-step meeting that's known in the entire country, right? And that's the one this priest started in this, you know, parish. And I had what I had, I got, had a conviction experience, and I began to cry. I realized what a selfish bastard I had been, and I thought about all the money that I was capable of wasting on stupid stuff. And I turned to the guy next to me and I said, I'm going to go. And I got back, and the first thing I did Monday morning was called the guys and said, okay, I'm going. And then what happened was people in the recovering community started to hear about the fact that I was going, and people asked if they could donate to my trip. And not only did they donate to my trip, but we ended up mounting this campaign where we bootleg copied the Alcoholics Anonymous book. We actually got a copy of it and tore it apart and scanned it. And
you got
found
a Russian copy?
Yeah, Russian translation, yeah, and scanned it and bootlegged 752 copies that we packed into four separate duffel bags and took into the country with four separate people, and they all made it in. Right. And one of the things.
Are these like illegal copies then? Or?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. On multiple levels.
So you're smuggling in copies of the book.
Yeah, the Kazakhs are kind of funny about external literature. They're worse now than they were then. But they don't like you bringing in outside literature. So.
Yeah.
But of course we gave them all away. And I think I may have told you the story. You know, we walk into this, people were blown away that we would give them these books everywhere we went. But this one meeting with these six guys had grown, and we walk in, and they walk out with their book, right? I mean, this entire group has a single copy of this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And of course, I've got a backpack full of books ready to give them. And these guys, you know, they didn't carry it on a pillow, but they could have, you know. I mean, it was very. I mean, it was moving to think that these guys, that we started passing out these books, and these people begin to weep because they can't believe they get to take one of these books home. Well, you know. Recovering people in the United States take a fairly cavalier attitude about their recovery literature, so. Never again. You know.
One of the things you talked to me about, Jim, last Friday when we were having dinner, was you talked about this term that I had never known was in the recovery language, but you called this term the language of the heart.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so just describe that a little bit, about what it means and your experience of it.
Yeah, well, it was a term coined by Bill Wilson, who founded, one of the co-founders of AA. And, you know, He described it as this kind of special thing that happens between addicts and alcoholics when they start to talk to one another. I mean, he got sober. He had a kind of a profound spiritual experience, but he ended up going to visit a guy. He found himself in a failed business deal in Akron, Ohio, and he realized that he needed to find another alcoholic to talk to in order for him to stay sober. And he found this drunken doctor. He was actually a rectal surgeon, which is a frightening thought. Alcoholic rectal surgeon.
Hey, I think if that was my work, I'd be an alcoholic as well.
Well, I don't know, but this guy. But the first meeting they set up, the guy was too drunk to come. And then the next time they set it up, he really didn't want to talk to Bill Wilson. He just said, I'll give him 15 minutes, and they talked for 6 hours. And that guy stayed sober, and then they went and found a third guy, and they sat down and talked with him, and something magical happened, and that guy got sober. And that's where Bill Wilson coined that phrase, you know. I have another friend who says that 12-step recovery is like Amway without the money, you know. But I have certainly seen, you know, I saw it in Kazakhstan. I've been to Hong Kong and the Philippines and Japan and Mexico, and I found that even through a translator, there's something that happens between people in recovery that's kind of magical. It's, you know, I suspect that part of it is our history of being broken.
Why don't you tell a little bit, Jim, about, so you're in Hong Kong in one of Jackie Pullinger's places, and you are an American who doesn't understand Chinese, so you're having to speak through a translator. But all the other workers there are. Why don't you sort of just tell a little bit?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I spent a week there and lived for the most part in these treatment centers, and most of the time I spent was in a little fishing village in the southwest corner of Lantau Island called Dai O Village, and it was on the outskirts of Dai O Village. It was way far from home, and it was entirely Chinese, except the staff were all British or New Zealanders. Jackie Pullinger is British originally. And even though I found her very responsive, very sensitive to the cultural, and she obviously loved Chinese. She loved Chinese people. She loved everything about it. A lot of the folks who were there were not nearly as comfortable as she was. But I arrived there and got to know these guys, and pretty quickly, you know, I mean, they were the faces
and you get to know them through a translator. So it's
yeah. There was a young man named Simon, and he was the only person in the group who could speak English. And the word was that if he didn't like you, he would just randomly mistranslate what you said just to be funny.
And you would have no clue.
Well, that's right. And of course, they'd never let you know. You know, he'd let people know if you were a poser. But apparently, I told my story a little and identified with him and shared a little bit about who I was. And he liked me and translated pretty freely. And I got to know these guys well enough that, you know, I spoke to them the way I would speak to somebody I knew in recovery here, you know. And when I left, the head of that site said, "Who are you?" And she thought, you know, you have some kind of, you know, these guys, we've never seen these guys relate to a Westerner like you. And I was real quick to tell her that it wasn't anything that any gift I had other than the fact that I'm recovering. I said, you got to get more recovering people in here. You got to get people who are just like these guys. You know, I mean, that's where the magic happens.
And the thing that amazes me is, I have been in international cultures where there's language issues, but, you know, the language issues I've had are Western languages, you know, English versus French, not English versus Chinese. But the language issues are huge barriers between people, and yet you had a connection with them. And to me, that still feels like that thing you called the language of the heart.
Yeah, everywhere I've gone, I've had that experience, you know. We're like, you know, Bill Wilson once said that recovering people are like the survivors of the Titanic. You know, like we're the people who made it through this horrible tragedy and came out and are survivors. And it does something different. I still remember in Kazakhstan, we went to a place. We traveled quite a bit through this country, this Eurasian steppe, a pretty bleak country in many respects. But we went to one place because we'd heard that there was a guy in this town, I think it was Kelerovka, and this guy, I can't remember his name, but he had gotten a hold of a copy of the Russian translation of this book and had gotten sober and had more than a year of sobriety and had never met another recovering person. And, of course, alcoholism is just rampant in that country, just terrible.
Yeah.
Alcohol is cheaper than bottled water. And so we arrived in this town and met this guy. And as we walked up to one another, we both began to weep, right? Us because, it was just this funny little thing, you know, where we were the first recovering addicts, alcoholics he'd ever met.
Hmm.
You know, that's just amazing stuff, so.
And so is the connection partly the fact of, I don't know, a shared recognition of brokenness?
Oh, no question. No question, yeah. And of course, it's characterized by a lot of laughter. I mean, we tend, you know, if you nearly died and really just run yourself into the ground, you know, you don't take yourself as seriously. You know, I mean, 12-step recovery meetings are characterized by the amount of laughter. You know, we say that we're the ones who laugh at our suicide attempts. You know, and sometimes people are perplexed. Sometimes people are horrified at the stuff that we think is funny.
So. I remember. So, I mean, one of the funny things that you would say that was funny so you and I are sitting for dinner last Friday, and your wife says, "Thank God for, you know, recovery, and thank God for the 12-step program."
Oh, yeah.
And you turned to her and said, and what did you say?
Oh, yeah, we were telling us. Yeah, she and I had been coming back from a meeting where we heard a person tell his story, what's called an open talk, and she did. It was been a particularly nice, good talk, and she said, "Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "Yeah, but thank God for drugs and alcohol." And she looked at me. It was a bad look. And I said, you know, if it
I know that kind of look, by the way.
Yeah. I said, if it hadn't been for drugs and alcohol, I would have killed myself when I was 14 years old.
Hmm.
You know. And that, so, I mean, there's some real truth to that, you know.
Yeah. So, Jim, weave together something for me. So, you know, from what you've told us, there's so much more to your story than what you're able to tell us right now, but... So you have this experience of going in this meeting when this guy invites you in for a cup of coffee, and
Yeah.
And there's a changing point, and then you go through this residential program. There's a changing point, and then you talk about this conviction experience that you had, and now you're talking about this idea of language of the heart that's brought up in that book.
Mm-hmm.
How do all these things, and I'm sure there are more, weave together, connect together, to make you the man you are today, doing what you're doing today, creating the passion and let me just put it in this terms, and the brilliance that you have today that you bring to the world? Kind of connect those things for us, because it's a fascinating story, and we haven't even gotten to what you're currently doing today in specific yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, at this point, it is kind of funny. You know, I'll be, this summer, I'll have, God willing, I'll have 42 years of continuous sobriety. So it is ironic that I was the young guy, you know. I mean, I was the identified young guy back then, and now I'm the old guy. So that's a little strange. And I am about to celebrate 40 years in the field, which is nuts, and 30 years at the farm, which is also kind of nuts. I think my story is one of, you know, God being, so a friend of mine once, Sam, you know, Mark Enser, once said that, my story was a story of God's faithfulness to me. Not necessarily always my faithfulness to God, but God's faithfulness to me. And that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. I've been taken pretty good care of, and you know, there's a saying we have, some friends of mine, that we say, if life was fair, I'd be dead. You know? I mean, yeah. It's actually
this
true.
Is
there are a number
of you you're talking about.
Well, there are a number of us who are sort of, you know, old dope fiends who are now in our 60s, and we were completely unprepared to live this long. So we're like, what do we do now? You know, it's pretty funny, because we all figured we'd die young. You know.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question. With all of your years of experience, is everybody capable of an addiction in their life?
That's a good question. I mean, it depends on what you mean by addiction. Is anybody capable of becoming unhealthily dependent? Probably. Is anybody capable of becoming like a heroin addict? No. No, I don't believe so, based on everything I know.
Okay.
Yeah, I do make a distinction between what we sometimes call process addictions, or things that look more like a form of obsessive compulsive disorder. Based on all the science I've read, you can't become a heroin addict, for example, unless your brain is hardwired for it.
Are you serious?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean,
It's the poster child of addiction as a brain disease, because most people, when they take an, you can't be 21 years old in the United States and not have taken an opiate. You know, you break a limb or you get dental work or something happens and you get some kind of opiate-based medication. Most people, it makes them queasy and sick to their stomach and a little muddy, and as soon as they can get off of it, they're pretty happy to do that. I tell heroin addicts that, and they can't believe it. They just can't believe it, because they take it and they have what we sometimes call a signature experience, and they feel great and wonderful, and instead of wanting to sleep it off, they want to rearrange their closet at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's a brain disease. So yeah, so substance addiction certainly looks like it's pretty pure biology.
Okay, so it's fascinating to talk about. There's a difference between being obsessive compulsive and being addicted. I've never thought in terms of that.
So would you call a sexual addiction, and you hear all these sex addicts, would you call that a compulsive disorder as opposed
yeah.
to...
Yeah. Well, yeah, they're, you know... The
brain is producing endorphins and different things.
Yeah, the science is changing, and I mentioned OCD. You know, there are some people who are thinking that they're going to eventually find a root biology behind OCD, and that substance addictions are going to be some offshoot of that. So, and it may, you know, they may. Right now, some of the things that we characterize addiction as having don't exist with some of these what we call process addictions. For example, I mean, there's not a discrete withdrawal syndrome. There's what sometimes looks like tolerance, but you're not really talking about the same kind of mechanism. So there's things that are different, you know.
Okay, so as you've worked with people with addictions, what are some of those really important, you know, I don't want to call them life skills, but things that give a person the ability to stay away from addictions versus the person that can't, because certain things maybe are missing in their life and create a vacuum, create a vulnerability, or is that correct?
Yeah, well, yeah, I think the biggest, if there's a single myth about addiction, it's, you know, I go to a Rotary Club or something and somebody will say, I have too much willpower to be an addict or an alcoholic. And I always laugh because addicts and alcoholics have enormous willpower, enormous lack of, willpower is not the problem. And in fact, the solution for recovery, as I know it from my experience, is that people need to learn how to deflate their ego. They need to learn how to get out of the way. They need to learn how to practice this a certain amount of acceptance, and ultimately to practice what we call surrender. You know, it's funny. There was a book written about Alcoholics Anonymous years ago by a friend of mine, and it's considered kind of the scholarly book on the subject, and it's called Not God. And I've always thought it was just a wonderful title, because it's about the fact that, you know, it's not, you know, specifically what you pick, as long as you understand that you are not God. And the not God process is the root of recovery. The best thing that ever happened to me when I walked into that very first meeting, almost 41 and a half years ago, was I was broken enough that I was willing to follow direction. And I mentally said, I will do what these people tell me to do, I will do.
So in a certain sense, you're saying the problem isn't not enough willpower, it's almost too much willpower.
Oh, that's one of the reasons why traditional psychotherapy doesn't work with addicts and alcoholics. I mean, they, you know, they're smart and they have insight and they participate in the therapeutic process and they even pay their bill for a while and then they get drunk, you know. And therapists all over the country scratch their heads and say, why did this happen? And, of course, the reason is that most traditional modern psychotherapy models are all about being in control, being empowered, being, you know, managing your life. And addicts and alcoholics need to learn how to stop managing their lives. I mean, it is funny, you know, the first step of the 12 steps says, admitted we were powerless. And it's a funny thing, because when people are new confronting that step, that word just hurts. The concept of being powerless is just painful and awful. And then, after a period of time and people, you know, learn what recovery is like, today the word powerless to me brings relief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it really is funny that a single word like that can mean such different things depending upon which side of recovery you're sitting.
Mm-hmm. So, Jim, we are, you know, the group of men and women that you're talking to right now have a common connection together, and that's because we're learning how to understand what God's call on our life is. So we have some mm-hmm. common language. We've been on retreats. We've read books, but we understand our calling. As I heard you talking about your life, one of the things that really sort of jumped out at me was you're talking about going to Minneapolis and seeing the absence of a country, the absence of a 12-step program, and your heart breaks.
Yeah, sure.
So sort of in that context, what would you say, you know, without even knowing our terminology, without knowing our language, what would you say is the call on your life?
Oh, well, I mean, ultimately, I mean, my purpose is to try and be of maximum service to God. I mean, I you know, I'm one of those people who, you know, legitimately, this is funny, Sam, you know my wife, we've joked about this over the years that she has been known on occasion to struggle with her self-image before God, you know, in ways that I tend not to. Now she's a, you know, she's the real deal. She's a serious holy woman. And I had a few bumps in the road. But one of the things that I consider a tremendous gift is that I don't have any fantasy about my capacity to get there on my own. It's all grace. It's, I mean, my life has been all grace. I have been rescued on a daily basis, you know. Because left to my own devices, I would be a wreck, you know.
That's such a powerful thing, Jim, that given to your own devices, you wouldn't make it. I mean, you just, there is that humility and lightness of living in the fact that, I don't think I live there enough. I mean, if you say that, I want to say that with all of my heart, but I'm not sure I can. You know,
You don't want to get beat up the way we. If you,
well, that's true.
If there's a way you can figure it out, that's a good thing.
But I think that message that you have there about being broken and saying my life is a life of grace every day is a message we all need to hear. I mean, it's something. You know, I'm sort of reminded of the parable of the prodigal son, where you have the younger son and the older son, and the younger son gets it, and the older son is sort of a son of a bitch. You know, he's saying,
although,
I slaved for you, father. You know, go ahead, correct me.
It is funny. I will tell you that having been, I relate a lot to the younger son of the prodigal story, but I've had, you know, the funny thing is that if you stay sober long enough, and you know, you work and you raise a family and all that, then you end up getting to play the older son too. You know,
yeah, I know. We sort of flip-flop between them.
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, I found myself sitting at Mass on some holiday recently, being disturbed that these posers were here taking my spot. You know, it's just, you loser. You know, the fact that they let you go there is such a good thing. And you're, you know, I'm judging them, man. You know, who are these people, these miscreants, you know?
You know, Martin Luther, you know, the original Martin Luther back in the 1500s, he used to say the Christian life is like a drunken man trying to get on a horse. He says, we get on the horse and we fall off on one side and we're the older brother. We get back on the horse and we fall off on the other side and then we're the younger brother.
Yeah.
And we get back on the horse and we fall off and we're the older brother again.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty good picture sometimes.
Yeah, I do too. So Jim, real quickly, just what do your days look like now with your work and all?
Oh, well, actually, I'm on sabbatical right now, but I'm in the process. I'm writing
as of Monday.
As of Monday, yeah. So I'm right now I'm not so sure. I'm going to be doing some traveling and I'm going to be writing a book about the farm.
Okay.
But when I'm at the farm, I mean, I manage, it's a sizable organization now, and we have about 75 employees, and we have multiple sites. But one of the things I do, I admit clients. I still see clients. I'm probably the most expensive intake worker around, but I love, it's one of my favorite things is actually talking to people who are new. So I think if there's a sickness while I'm on sabbatical, that's probably going to be it. I mean, I work with a great group of people. The organization that I work for is a strongly mission driven, values driven organization. And one of the reasons I'm writing this book is because there's sort of no good reason for us to survive. We're very grassroots, you know, founded by a couple of recovering addicts, and we've survived when thousands of hospital programs and publicly funded and insurance funded programs have all gone out of business. And we're still around. We're doing pretty well, actually. And it really is kind of miraculous. We've been, you know, God's taken pretty good care of us. And so one of the things we're going to try and do is write down some of the things that we've learned that we think have kept us alive. You know, things like not chasing money, making decisions based on our values, not based on, we have a saying at the farm, never make a decision based on fear. And I think that's something that kind of drives us. We're not afraid of making mistakes, but we don't make fundamental decisions based on fear. So, and so far, 40 years, we're still around, which is kind of amazing.
Yep, that is.
So.
Hey, you know, Jim and Gary, this has just been a great conversation. Jim, I've enjoyed catching up, and I know that you're saying these are old stories, but for me, they're new stories.
Yeah.
I really do appreciate the wisdom that you're offering and the insight you're offering, and you know, even that last line, never make decisions based on fear.
That may be the only actual thing that you can actually say you heard that I said. You know,
it's an original Jim Ballmer quote.
If that actually may be an original, I may be wrong, but we think that may be. You can quote me.
I think that's brilliant. I mean,
I think it's pretty funny.
I think so many times we screw up our lives when we make decisions rushed because of fear.
Yeah.
Oh,
and we're
blinded
by some of those things that are causing us the fear.
Right. Well, if I didn't have a relationship with God and if I didn't have a program of recovery to work, I would live pretty much consumed with fear. You know, and the baseline for people like me is to be afraid. You know, so you know the. I mean, you have to. You have to practice not living that way.
Yep.
I think we all have to practice not living that way. I think we all do.
Yeah.
So, Jim, I want to thank you on behalf of everybody who's been on the discussion, people that are sort of writing in comments and observations about stuff, and I think people really enjoyed this. So,
happy to do it.
And you need to know, Jim, a bunch of guys are going, man, I really like this guy.
Yeah.
I really like to spend time with him. I happen to say me too a number of times over that comment. So,
yeah,
so
I think we need to get you back on again.
Yep.
Sure. Oh, sure. Yeah, I'll tell you my conversion story.
Yeah, and
that's a funny story.
And I need to go out to dinner with you again.
Oh, anytime.
Yeah.
Happy to.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yep. Take care.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Bye.